Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support of WBUR. Please pledge online at WBUR.org or by calling 1-800-909-9287.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In scores of cities across the country yesterday, big rallies calling for legal status for the millions of illegal immigrants in the United States. 11, maybe 12 million illegals in all in the U.S., and by far the biggest portion from Mexico. The story behind the story of the immigration debate is really about the United States and Mexico, and some would say the inexorable convergence of their two economies and cultures. No border fence, economists say, can stop it. But does it really work for everyone? Mexico is poor. Many Americans are worried. Up next on Point, as the rallies spread, the slow and steady marriage of the USA and Mexico. We begin with the latest from Washington on the immigration front. Joining me is Maura Reynolds, congressional correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She covered yesterday's big rally in the Capitol. Maura, thanks for being with us. What did it look like there yesterday?
A sea of white T-shirts and American flags.
And the message that was coming out of that, how do you think the U.S. Congress is going to read it?
That remains to be seen, I think, in the next several days. There was some backlash from some of the rallies several weeks ago where protesters seemed to be carrying more Mexican flags and flags of other countries than they were American flags. And I was told by many Republican congressmen that this was having the effect of galvanizing the anti-immigrant voices in their community. So I think it remains to be seen. The organizers of yesterday's protest made a special effort to have American flags predominate, to have marchers wear white T-shirts in a sign of peace, to carry signs that said, "We are America," to try to send a message that they want to become Americans.
And they seem to have succeeded in putting that message up front. Chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Arlen Specter, saying over the weekend that he's still optimistic that senators can pass a bill on immigration when they get back from their spring break here. He said, "I think tempers will cool." Is there any sense, Maura, of what a new compromise, what a bill that could pass the Senate might look like?
Well, the compromise that they had when they left had a majority support of the Senate. It had the support of most Democrats and enough Republicans to put it over the 50% mark. The problem was that the rancor and the procedures and a certain lack of goodwill between the two sides really stalled it. So apparently the way it's been described to me is that the train is stopped on the tracks, but it's not derailed yet. So I think we'll see in a couple of weeks whether that train gets going again.
Washington Post ABC News poll finding 3/4 of Americans think the government is not doing enough to prevent illegal immigration, but 3 out of 5 say they favor providing illegal immigrants who have lived here for years a way to get legal status, eventual citizenship. Only 1 in 5 Americans polled embracing the much tougher House bill. Do you have any sense more of how congressmen are going to come back from this break? They're home now. They were in many of these cities as those huge crowds came out yesterday. How do you think this is going to play?
Well, before they left, there was a real sense that they weren't really sure which way the country was moving on this. And I think that they've got their ears tuned pretty closely right now to the mood in their districts. Some people were saying yesterday, you know, why did we have this very large rally in Washington when Congress wasn't even in town? But members of Congress, both the Senate and the House, really pay much more attention to the public reaction in their districts. And so they're in their districts now. Their constituents are watching the news on television, and I think they're going to be listening very closely to see what their constituents have to say about it.
And Republicans, Democrats, each have an iron in the fire here, kind of different irons. Who seems to be more trouble over this, having more difficulty in digesting this picture?
The Republicans, definitely, because there's a certain portion of the Republican base, call it sort of the law and order cohort, who just really doesn't like the idea of anyone coming into the United States illegally, even if they've got the good intention of working and supporting their families. And then other parts of the Republican especially the Republican leadership, look at the large Latino population, recognize that it's a mixture of legal and illegal residents, and want to get those people as voters in the future. They see immigrants as being particularly hardworking, embodying a lot of Republican ideals, and including community and religion, and they would like to have those people as a part of their party. So, you know, they're kind of two minds about it, and this is playing out very much day to day in districts and in the minds of Republican congressmen across the country.
Rallies across the country, not just Washington, Manhattan, Atlanta, Mississippi, Madison, all over the place, Phoenix. But of course, rallies on the Mall often mark kind of historical moments or even turning points. Did it have that feeling to you yesterday, Maura Reynolds?
There were many people who said that it did, and the reason largely was that this is a population that is largely in the shadows. These are the housekeepers who come and go quietly, and the bricklayers who, you know, arrive in the dark of dawn and leave at dusk. And these were people who left their jobs, who gave up a day's wages, often who rely on those day's wages, live day to day, to come down and make a point. And, you know, we had many reporters out on the Mall talking, and everyone was, you know, being quite open about their status and how they arrived in the country. And that's a very unusual thing for this population to be so public. So many people are saying that this is the beginning of a mobilization that perhaps the authors of the more stringent anti-immigrant legislation might not have anticipated.
Maura Reynolds with the Los Angeles Times in Washington, thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
We're talking this hour about the USA and Mexico and their ever more intimate ties behind the immigration debate. You can join the conversation. When you look down the road, what do you see here? Do these two economies fit together, these two countries? Do they work together? Is this marriage inevitable? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We will hear later in this hour from former Mexican Foreign Minister Jorge Castaneda and from former Mayor of Mexico City and three-time Mexican presidential candidate Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas. But first, joining me from Pasadena, California, is Hector Tobar, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and Mexico City bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. He's the author of Translation Nation, Defining a New American Identity in the Spanish-speaking United States. Hector Tobar, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, you look out on this scene, and it really is, in many ways, a U.S.-Mexico story. Of course, there are immigrants from all over the world and certainly from other parts of Latin America, but the numbers are so big from Mexico. It really feels like the issue here, in some dimension, is whether or not we've got a slow-motion merger underway between these two countries and cultures and economies. How do you look at that, Hector?
Well, definitely the United States and Mexico are two countries that are ever more intertwined, not only in the economic sense, but also in the political and cultural sense. As you know, there are great many sections of the United States that have more and more of a Latin feel. And now that I'm reporting from Mexico, I really sort of feel the influence of the United States and its institutions and its model, its economic model in Mexico itself.
We're going to hear later in this hour from an economist who says there's no way a border can stop the merger of these economies. But these are very different countries. You've got almost 300 million Americans now, more than 100 million Mexicans. U.S. GDP per capita, $42,000. Mexico GDP per capita, $10,000. Far less. And if you cipher into that, the inequality of Mexican incomes probably looks worse than that sounds. Do these economies fit together, Hector?
What you point out is exactly sort of the crux of the issue, is the great disparities in wealth between the United States and Mexico, which of course is what drives immigration. Mm-hmm. And the question is whether in integrating the two economies, whether some of the social dysfunction of Mexico, some of the root causes of poverty, are themselves in danger of being exported to large regions of the United States. Mexico is a country which has attempted in the last decade or so to adapt the models of globalization, and all it's done is to increase the great disparities of wealth and poverty in the country. So I think that the final word has not been written in Mexico on whether or not both integration and the vast migration of so many Mexicans to the United States is a good thing for Mexico.
We've been talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and Mexico City bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times, Hector Tobar. We're joined right now from Mexico City by Jorge Castaneda, former foreign minister of Mexico under President Vicente Fox from 2000 to 2003. He's currently a professor of politics and Latin American studies at New York University. Jorge Castaneda, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
I wonder how you're looking on at this whole debate and the rallies over immigration in the United States. You've long been a kind of promoter of an EU-style relationship between these two countries. Do you see convergence in these immigration numbers and these rallies in the streets?
Well, absolutely. I think what we're seeing now in the streets and in the debate in the United States, Tom, is what we in fact know has been going on for a long time, which is that an enormous amount of people from Mexico have gone to the United States to work. Some have gone in an authorized fashion, others in an unauthorized fashion, others somewhere in between. But it's an enormous amount of people because the two economies are coming together. And as you have more and freer movement of capital and of goods and services, you also end up having freer and freer movement of people. You can either make it legal, secure, humane, which is what President Fox's government has been trying to achieve with the United States, and many people in the U.S. have been trying to achieve over the last 6 years, or you can have it through the desert illegally in very adverse conditions. But it happens anyway. You cannot have two economies coming together so closely as the U.S. and Mexican economies are coming together without there being more and more people moving back and forth.
But, you know, there's always been the restraint on this merger of that border. Permeable as it may be, it's not that easy to get across. It's dangerous. 400 or 500 people die every year trying. If that is opened further, if only symbolically, through a path to legal status in the United States, does this merger work, Jorge Castaneda? Does it work for Mexico? Does it work for the United States? These are two very different economies at the same time.
Well, they are two different economies. They're wider apart than the poorer and wealthier economies were in Europe when the European Common Market, then the European Economic Community, and now the European Union were formed ever since 1958. Yes, the gap between the United States and Mexico is wider, unquestionably. At the same time, the links are perhaps tighter than before. In the case of Mexico, 95% of our trade is with the United States. 90% of tourists who come to Mexico, which is perhaps our most important industry, tourism, 90% come from the United States. And something like 60, perhaps 65% of the people we saw marching yesterday all over the United States, and really a glorious expression of American freedom and liberty and of Mexican participation, 65, 70% perhaps are Mexican. So there's a much greater concentration of ties between the U.S. and Mexico than ever existed in Europe, even if the gap is much wider. Can it work for both countries? Yes, it can, if both countries decide that they want to make it work.
How do you look at the balance of power here, Mr. Castaneda, and the stakes? You know, some Mexicans in the United States talk about a reconquista, that is, taking back land, in effect, that was taken from Mexico by the United States in the 19th century. Is there a kind of taking back our own feeling to this? Or do you, on the other hand, see it as a kind of submission to greater American power if these two countries become closer and closer?
I see neither of the two. I think that the Reconquista vision is a bit naive and perhaps a little bit counterproductive. It leads to views such as those of Samuel Huntington in his now famous book, or infamous book, Who Are We?, and tries to establish a difference between Mexican immigrants to the United States and immigrants from all over the world, the rest of the world, to the United States. The Mexicans, according to Huntington and others, would want to take back what was theirs. Well, first of all, it's arguable exactly how ours, all of that territory, was in 1847. Who were we, Mexicans, in 1847? Most historians would say we didn't really exist as a nation, as Mexico, in 1847. The United States took it away, but it's not clear that they took it away from us, firstly. And secondly, this is clearly an irreversible historical fact that I think nothing is gained by stressing the difference between Mexican immigration to the U.S. and immigration from other parts. Conversely, submitting to U.S. power, I think Mexico has already been in this situation for many, many years. During World War One, 95% of our foreign trade was with the United States because, of course, it was the only country we could trade with, given the war in Europe and German U-boats, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So, really, this is just a de facto situation which has been going on for many, many years, Tom.
Look at it from an American point of view for a second. Mexico has tremendous inequality of wealth. Of course, the United States has its own version, but Mexico is much, much more exaggerated. One of the most unequal distributions of wealth in the world. It's also only had real democracy very, very recently. Is the economic and political culture that comes with these closer ties healthy for the United States?
Well, certainly on the democratic front, I think a condition for closer ties and convergence between Mexico and the United States was that Mexico moved towards democratic rule, which it began to do in the mid-1990s and really consolidated that trend in the 2000 election when Vicente Fox was elected president, the first non-PRI president of Mexico ever. I think this was a very important step. The rest is true. There is a huge inequality in Mexico. Living standards are much lower than in the United States. Educational levels are much lower, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is a fact. But it's precisely that fact which is leading so many hundreds of thousands of Mexicans to move to the United States over years. If the United States could really do something about it, then perhaps it might have a choice. But the fact is that choice doesn't exist. So it seems much wiser take a different tack, a different approach, and try and see how the gap can be reduced and how the differences in economic prosperity, in educational levels, in income levels, in productivity levels, etc., can be reduced instead of trying to wish them away as if they could go away. They won't.
So you're saying either the United States reaches into Mexico to help with development, or Mexicans will reach, as they are very much already, into the United States itself.
Well, this is why the argument that I know some of my good friends in the United States have against a guest worker program, saying that it will take low-skilled jobs away from Americans, supposing that were the case, and this is something that is very much argued about by economists and scholars working on these issues. Well, if it were the case, then the next step, if Americans were to take those jobs at $25 an hour, we know what would happen. The jobs would move elsewhere. Either Mexicans take those jobs in the U.S. or the jobs in the U.S. go elsewhere. It's not the case of everything. You can't do it with restaurants and gardens, et cetera, but you certainly can do it with low-skill, low-wage jobs that can move offshore. And as a matter of fact, they have been moving offshore from the United States. They have been outsourced. So it's one of the two has to happen. Probably it makes more sense for there to be a combination. And I think that the United States helps Mexico, and Mexico helps the United States with secure, humane, legal immigration from Mexico to the United States, closing the gap little by little, as occurred in Europe, even though the gap was smaller. I still remember, Tom, in the late 60s and early 70s, when hundreds of thousands of Spanish and Portuguese workers went to France, to Germany, to Britain, to many countries in Northern Europe, much more prosperous than Spain and Portugal, in conditions not unsimilar to those of Mexicans in the United States, except they began to be legal after the mid-80s. Well, what happened? With time, Portugal and Spain became increasingly productive, modernized, advanced, higher educational levels, and emigration from those two countries to Northern Europe simply ended. On the contrary, now Spain has a huge problem of immigration from North Africa.
But by the time the immigration ended, those economies had come much closer to Northern Europe's. Jorge Castaneda, I know we have to let you go. We've been delighted to have you joining us from Mexico City. We're very grateful to you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
The former foreign minister of Mexico under President Vicente Fox, Jorge Castaneda. Jim's calling right now from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to point out that I read almost daily where millions of Americans are saving little or nothing for retirement.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we're going to see over the next couple of decades a mass migration of Americans to Mexico and other Latin American countries in order to be able to afford to retire.
You know, Jim, I know exactly what you mean. I was in Mexico myself recently. There's lots of evidence of that already. It's easy to imagine sort of graying Americans heading south as young Mexicans and others head north. Thanks very much for your call. I want to welcome into our conversation from Denton, Texas, David Molina, professor of economics at the University of North Texas, director of the university's Center of Inter-American Studies and Research. Professor Molina, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So here's this picture, millions of Mexicans coming north. As our caller Jim says, many Americans going south, and particularly as the boomers retire, it could be many, many more. Do we have a merger underway here, whatever we want to call it?
Clearly we have a merger, but going back to the your caller, it's sort of interesting because since IRCA, the 1986 Immigration Reform and Reform Act.
The last time there was big reform here in the U.S., yes?
Yeah, the last big amnesty program. One of the things employers are required to do is to have Social Security cards. Well, as many people, especially here in Texas and California, know, you can get Social Security cards for about $150, $200 in the black market. And a lot of these illegal undocumented workers are putting money into our Social Security fund. Right. In fact, we're putting in somewhere in the neighborhood of $7 billion a year. And so one of the things that nobody seems to be wanting to talk about on this side of the border is the fact that part of our baby boomers right now who are collecting Social Security are being funded by these undocumented workers
right.
who are putting in a tremendous amount of money.
Of course, this is put forward by people in favor of more liberal immigration rules. Opponents say yes, but lots of these immigrants are also showing up and depending on government services here. David Molina, as I read you, you say, well, it doesn't really matter that in terms of economic integration, the border is going to slowly collapse, whatever the policy may be.
And we've seen that. As a matter of fact, prior to NAFTA, most of the U.S.-Mexico trade occurred right on the border. We had factories on the Mexican side. We had warehouses on the American side. As NAFTA has gone through, these warehouses have moved in further inland on the U.S. side, and the factories have moved further inland on the Mexican side. And so what we were observing is that where it used to be the borders that were interconnected, it is now the states as we move further from the border as with our integration.
Let's turn to Silver Spring, Maryland, and Suma. Suma, are you with us?
Yes.
What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, what's on your mind, Suma? What do you think?
Yes. This sits in the heart of the concept of freedom. It goes beyond immigration in my own point of view. It sits in the heart of freedom because the early immigrants in 1617, 1800 came here in the pursuit of freedom, escaping persecution in Europe. They were faced with resistance. There were people here that were trying to discourage them and get them back. They resisted because they saw reasons and they saw that it was their inalienable right given to God, given by God to be able to choose, not only as to whether they want to worship God or not, but also to be able to determine as to where they want to go.
Suma, your telephone line is tough. You say it's all about freedom. Is it a good thing for the U.S. economy? Is it a good thing for both countries if this integration willy-nilly moves forward?
Good. Well, the point is, no country will be able to accept an uncontrollable inflow of immigrants into their own country. That is fact. So nobody is against, not me, is against any good, meaningful guidelines or laws to control the inflow of people into this country, but you cannot brandish those people that are already here as criminals for coming to seek freedom.
Yeah, we hear that, and it sounds like California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's line. He says Congress must attack the problem, not the people. Suma, thanks for calling. Hector Tobar, you know, what about it? Do you see in Mexico, in your reporting there, signs of the American reach south?
Am I seeing in – oh, definitely. You see the exportation of the idea of American business practices, of transparency. I remember going – living in Mexico 20 years ago, and the difference now is that you just see so many more American companies. You see American produce available in the markets. So there definitely has been a sort of greater Americanization of Mexico. Some people say that the reason why the Mexican waistline is increasing is because people are eating more packaged foods, which wasn't something that happened in Mexico 10 or 15 years ago. So definitely you are seeing growing presence of American institutions, of an American way of thinking in Mexico, but it's still Mexico, mm-hmm. and it still has great disparities of wealth and poverty. It still has an education system that's failing its people, and it's still exporting its most ambitious people to the United States to seek that way of life. Mm. And as far as this current debate, I think it's extremely important, especially thinking about what the last caller said, that we're in danger in the United States of creating sort of a two-tier society, and having 11 million people, or perhaps even more people, who have no legal status in the country, have no labor protections. It's a very dangerous thing for American society to have that sort of two-tier society.
But David Molina, we just got half a minute before the break. Mexico has a radically two-tiered society. Do we import that mentality when we open the borders to Mexican immigration?
To some extent, yes. But on the other hand, Estevar mentioned, some of the people coming are some of the more entrepreneur-minded individuals. And so that may not be quite as much as some people predict it might.
Letty is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Letty, you're on the air.
I totally disagree with this immigration thing, because what's going to happen to the American people? Some of these people are making a lot more than we are. Some of these people are on welfare, versus I used to be a single parent and I never fall into that category, versus I know a lot of illegal people that have no papers, yet they're receiving food stamps and help from the government.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing, too, is that they're claiming they have I don't know how many wives in Mexico with I don't know how many kids, yet they're getting all the internal revenue more than I am, versus I have to pay the internal revenue. So what about the American people? I mean, what's our retirement? I mean, what's going to happen with Social Security if all this is going to go on?
Letty, where were you born?
I was born in Mexico, and I came over here, and I was a single parent for so many years, and I've never fallen into the category of going into welfare.
Do you think these two countries can kind of merge, can come closer and closer together to the benefit of both or not, Letty?
No. I think that some of these people are just, I can understand that there's a few that could, come and do something good here in the United States. But they take all their money, they have houses, they come and work for a year, they get tired. They go over to Mexico, they can retire. I have to work all my life.
Letty, we hear it, and we're very grateful to you for sharing your view there, that from a woman yourself, an immigrant from Mexico, and thanks for your call. I want to turn once more to Mexico City, if I may. We have on the line with us there Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, former mayor of Mexico City, three-time presidential candidate in Mexico, a big mover and shaker in Mexican politics. His family has been very prominent for a long, long time. Mr. Cárdenas, thank you very much for joining us.
No, it's a pleasure being with you, Tom.
We spoke earlier with Jorge Castaneda. We're curious to get your view as well. You know, obviously, Mexico very well and the United States very well. Do you see these countries moving closer and closer together inexorably? Is it inevitable?
Well, we share a 2,000-mile frontier, and I think we shall be together. We have lots of diversity of exchanges between our two countries, and we share not only a common border, but I would say a common present and a common future.
But does it mean the United States being swamped by Mexican poverty? There's still many, many poor people in Mexico. Can they be digested into the American economic sphere? Can they come in without standards of living dropping all around?
Well, I think that we have to change policies in both countries, and we have to develop a policy in which we can reduce or eliminate these big differences existing right now. Social, economic differences can be reduced if we implement a different policy, different from the one that has been occurring during these last years.
And I know you've called for more American investment in Mexican infrastructure development. Is that a necessary prerequisite before these economies can become closer? Without that, is Mexico always the poor cousin?
No, I think that we must change our internal policies. Our internal economic policy should have as a priority to launch a process of economic growth that can sustain in the long term. We have to pay much more attention to our social problems, creation of jobs and better wages, better social security, and that's a decision that has to be taken by Mexicans in Mexico, and these changes have to be implemented in Mexico. But if we have a different relationship with the United States, that can help also to reduce the flow of migrants and to reduce the differences, the existing differences in our economies and social difference between the two countries.
But how compatible can these countries ultimately be? I mean, your father, Lázaro Cárdenas, famously redistributed land to peasant farmers in Mexico, nationalized Mexico's oil industry in the 30s, and still Mexico has tremendous inequality. How close can these countries really come? Is there something in the cultures that ultimately keeps them apart, or can they have an EU-style intimacy one day?
No, I think that we can, in both countries, improve the present situations. If we just take the example of Europe. In Europe, when the 15 European nations decided to unite to create the European Union, well, they derived investments from the most developed countries to the less developed countries. And they really reduced the differences, and they could integrate in this European Union. Investments from Germany, from England, from France flowed to Greece, to Spain, to Portugal, and those countries could improve their infrastructure, they could modernize their productive activities, and that's what I think should be done, not only between Mexico and the United States, but in the whole of our continent. Considering that we could develop a pact, an agreement of development for the whole continent.
There's the EU model front and center again. Mr. Cárdenas, I know we have to let you go. We appreciate your joining us from Mexico City. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, former mayor of Mexico City, three-time presidential candidate in Mexico. Douglas is calling right now from Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Douglas. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, thank you. I was just wondering why apparently all Mexican kids do not learn English from an early age of school, as is the case in, for example, most of Europe, and why that is, and what it would mean if it was a deliberate policy change by the Mexican government to do that. How would it be interpreted in Mexico, and how would it be interpreted in the United States? For example, would help strengthen the Mexican economy as well as prepare those people who want to emigrate.
Douglas, do you think that's the way it might one day go, or will it be American children learning Spanish as a second language? Are you favoring the integration suggested there or not?
Yes, I think that having Mexicans learn English would be very helpful, because that is essentially the, as we say, the lingua franca of the 21st century, right. The early 21st century.
David Molina, Douglas, thanks for your call. David Molina, how about it? In Europe, there's that kind of conscious step toward integration. Here, there's a lot of de facto integration, and yet things still clearly stand in its way. I don't know that Mexico does wide education in English as a second language, but if it were really into integration, why wouldn't it?
Well, first of all, they do that. But let me go back to another point.
Do you see evidence of that in the immigrants coming across the border? Are they typically bilingual?
Well, I think part of the problem you have is that some of the immigrants coming across the border have not much education. Mm-hmm. A lot of them don't even have an elementary school education. Mm-hmm. That's part of the problem. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, let me point out something. If you look at the 2000 census for both countries, on the Mexican side, nearly 45% of the population is under the age of 20.
Yep.
Compare that to about 26 or so in the U.S. No matter what job development program Mexico establishes, there is no economy in the world that could handle nearly half of its population being under the age of 20 and coming into the labor force.
So they're a young country. We're a relatively old country, certainly by comparison.
And so in economics, we call that a Pareto optimal. Basically, what we're going to have is we need young workers, and they have to find jobs for the new workers. And so I think there's going to be a much more stronger integration. I could say one more thing.
Yes, please.
One of the things that NAFTA was touted as the thing that would lower migration towards the U.S. rather than increase it. In fact, one of the most common things that President Salinas used to say was, we want to sell you goods, not our people.
Right.
Well, one of the things that has happened is if you look, for instance, at agricultural production in Mexico, the importation primarily of many of the main staples in Mexico has gone up by 161% since NAFTA, compared to their own production increasing by about 120%. And in fact, it is estimated right now that about 50% of all of the maize, the corn that Mexico consumes, comes from the U.S.
So they're importing their food, not necessarily growing it themselves. That must be tough on Mexican farmers.
And that means that Mexican farmers have a choice. They can either move to the city or they can move to another location where they can work in a farm. And so what we have seen is a tremendous amount of the Mexican immigrants that are coming are people who used to work in farms and no longer have that ability. And once they get here, they may not find a farm job, but they find the ability to find jobs elsewhere and at such higher incomes that Mexico's second source of revenue now is the remittances. It lags just right behind petroleum, and in some months it's actually even been higher than petroleum.
That is the flow of money being sent back home. That's pretty incredible that it's just as high as oil,
instance,
with oil price where it is these days.
Exactly. Just to give you an idea, remittances account for, if you compare it to tourism, remittances are 169%, almost 170%. In fact, even more significant, remittances are 112% of the foreign direct investment in Mexico. That's so in other words, the largest source outside of oil, of foreign currency into Mexico, is remittances.
Talk about being knitted together. There's a lot of evidence right there. Robin's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Robin. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Yes.
I think the merger has really already occurred virtually. Yeah. Our border with Canada has been that way for some time.
Mm.
And it's only been ethnic and economic reasons that Mexico has not been like that sooner. I'd also like to say that the recent uprising of Latinos can only work to the benefit of American laborers. As civil rights are granted to Latinos and they're no longer abused and their wages suppressed, their wages will go up and American workers will make more. One of your guests suggested that the only solution was for American workers to work for much less or there would be offshoring.
Mm-hmm.
So many of these jobs can't be offshored. There are a lot of Latino workers that are working for very small companies here in America.
And hotel workers and restaurant workers and so on.
It has to be here. And so as they demand their rights and their wages rise and they demand benefits, then they're going to begin to be able to work on a par with American laborers, and that's what should happen worldwide.
Robin, we take your point. We appreciate it. Hector Tobar, what about it? Is there anything approaching American-style labor rights such as they are today in Mexico? If we're talking about integration here, maybe some push of labor rights south is important to build a common platform.
Oh, absolutely. There is a very strong union movement in Mexico. There just is such a large pool of cheap labor that it makes it very difficult to push wages up in Mexico. And there's also a great deal of corruption. We recently had a mining disaster in northern Mexico in which it was revealed that the local union had really done almost nothing to protect the safety of about 80 workers who were buried alive in a mine. So there's a tremendous amount of corruption that sort of prevents people from exerting their labor rights in Mexico, which is why another reason why so many people sort of head northwards.
But, isn't there a chance that that lousy labor situation migrates with them? I mean, our caller Robin is pointing to the fact that, in a sense, it already does because they come north. They don't have rights. The U.S. labor standing may be is diminished when there's not a common grounding there on labor.
No, I think that's been true for a couple of generations now that we've seen this massive migration. But what we've seen now in the last month has really been very encouraging in terms of people stepping forward and claiming their rights and aspiring to citizenship in the United States, saying that we recognize that we've come here to work, that we thought we would be temporary, but we really feel that we now belong in this country, that we've contributed something to this country, and that we are going to join this long American tradition of seeking to fight our way in, shout our way in, plead our way into the American political system with all the protections it offers. And to see it not just in Los Angeles, not just in Miami or even just Dallas, but to see it in Mississippi and North Carolina, to see it in so many places where now the Mexican diaspora, the Central American diaspora, has taken people. I think it's a key moment in American history.
Let's listen to our listeners. Marilyn's calling from Houston, Texas. Hi, Marilyn. You're on the air.
I'm sorry. Are they going to be going to, if they get legal status here, are they going to be joining the army as well and go to Iraq whenever it's needed, or do they just want to come and just earn the money and that is it?
I've heard of a lot of immigrants actually joining the U.S. military as a faster track to legal status here. You're right, Marilyn. There are responsibilities and burdens there, too. Let me get Jack in Foxborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi. Quickly, please, Jack. Our time is short.
Okay. Well, I think we've got to be a little more creative. I agree with our senator that this is an 18th century solution to a 21st century problem, this idea of a wall. I'd like to see statehood offered to Mexico.
Do they have their pride? Do you think they'd want it?
Well, I think it's an easy sell. Just need somebody with some force and some ability to discern information. After all, they have tremendous natural resources. They have tremendous problems. And we have a huge 2,000-mile border, which is indefensible.
Yeah, Jack, we've got it, and our time's running right up. But there's a big welcome, Matt, and it's red, white, and blue. David Molina, what do you see as the structure in the minute we've got left here? If these countries do come closer together, who knows? But if they do, what structure will it have? Will it continue to be this kind of de facto NAFTA plus version, or something ultimately more tightly structured like the EU?
I'm not sure it'll be like the EU anytime soon, but I think what we're observing is that economic realities are generally always at least a mile ahead of political realities. We are integrated in terms of consumer income, workers, just about everything you can think of. The two economies have been integrated. It is just the political that's lagging behind.
Well, there's a little picture of the future. Picture it. Americans flowing south, Mexicans flowing north. A lot of it's happening already. David Molina, professor of economics at the University of North Texas. Thank you very much, professor, for being with us today. And Hector Tobar. Professor Molina. And Hector Tobar in Pasadena, Mexico City bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times, author of Translation Nation. Hector, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.